libraries that contained many historical books and records. The largest of these collections were probably at Undertowers, at Great Smiles, and at Brandy Hall. This account of the end of the Third Age is drawn mainly from the Red Book of Westmarch. That most important source for the history of the War of the Ring was so called because it was long preserved at Undertowers, the home of the Fairbairns, Wardens of the Westmarch. It was in origin Bilbo's private diary, which he took with him to Rivendell. Frodo brought it back to the Shire, together with many loose leaves of notes, and during Shire Reckoning 1420-21, he nearly filled its pages with his account of the war. But annexed to it, and preserved with it, probably in a single red case, were the three large volumes, bound in red leather, that Bilbo gave to him as a parting gift. To these four volumes there was added in Westmarch a fifth containing commentaries, genealogies, and various other matter concerning the hobbit members of the fellowship. The original Red Book has not been preserved, but many copies were made, especially of the first volume, for the use of the descendants of the children of Master Samwise. The most important copy, however, has a different history. It was kept at Great Smiles, but it was written in Gondor, probably at the request of the great-grandson of Peregrin, and completed in Shire Reckoning 1592. Its southern scribe appended this note: Findagil, King's writer, finished this work in 4172. It is an exact copy in all details of the Thane's book in Minas Tirith. That book was a copy, made at the request of King Elessar, of the Red Book of Pirianath, and was brought to him by the Thane Peregrin when he retired to Gondor in 464. The Thane's book was thus the first copy made of the Red Book, and contained much that was later omitted or lost. In Minas Tirith it received much annotation, and many corrections, especially of names, words, and quotations in the Elvish languages, and there was added to it an abbreviated version of those parts of the Tale of Aragorn and Arwen which lie outside the account of the war. The full tale is stated to have been written by Barahir, grandson of the steward Faramir, some time after the passing of the king. But the chief importance of Findigil's copy is that it alone contains the whole of Bilbo's translations from the Elvish. These three volumes were found to be a work of great skill and learning in which, between 1403 and 1418, he had used all the sources available to him in Rivendell, both living and written. But since they were little used by Frodo, being almost entirely concerned with the elder days, no more is said of them here. Since Merry Ardoch and Peregrin became the heads of their great families, and at the same time kept up their connections with Rohan and Gondor, the libraries at Bucklebrae and Tuckborough contained much that did not appear in the Red Book. In Brandy Hall there were many works dealing with Eriador and the history of Rohan. Some of these were composed or begun by Merry Ardoch himself, though in the Shire he was chiefly remembered for his Herblore of the Shire, and for his Reckoning of Years, in which he discussed the relation of the calendars of the Shire and Bree to those of Rivendell, Gondor, and Rohan. He also wrote a short treatise on old words and names in the Shire, showing special interest in discovering the kinship with the language of the Rohirrim of such Shire words as Matham and old elements in place names. At Great Smiles, the books were of less interest to Shire folk, though more important for larger history. None of them was written by Peregrin, but he and his successors collected many manuscripts written by scribes of Gondor, mainly copies of summaries of histories or legends relating to Elendil and his heirs. Only here in the Shire were to be found extensive materials for the history of Numenor and the arising of Sauron. It was probably at Great Smiles that the Tale of Years was put together, with the assistance of material collected by Merry Ardoch. Though the dates given are often conjectural, especially for the Second Age, they deserve attention. It is probable that Meriadoc obtained assistance and information from Rivendell, which he visited more than once. There, though Elrond had departed, his sons long remained, together with some of the high elven folk. It is said that Celeborn went to dwell there after the departure of Galadriel, but there is no record of the day when at last he sought the Grey Havens, and with him went the last living memory of the elder days in Middle-earth.
The End. This ends the author's note, marking the end of the recorded books production of the Lord of the Rings trilogy by J.R.R. Tolkien, narrated in its entirety by Robert Inglis. J.R.R. Tolkien wrote an appendix to The Lord of the Rings entitled The Annals of the Kings and Rulers. This book chronicles in detail the Numenorean kings, the House of Ael, and Durin's folk. The chief purpose of this appendix is to further illuminate the War of the Ring, and it alludes to the legends of the First Age, including the creation of the Silmarilli, the Three Jewels, and the founding of the realm of Numenor. The Annals of the Kings and Rulers is primarily concerned with the Second and Third Ages, the war against Sauron, the establishment by Elendil of the Numenorean realms in exile, Arnor and Gondor, the taking of the One Ring by Isildur, the history of the stewards of Gondor, and the destruction of the One Ring, which marks the end of the Third Age. Tolkien also recounts the tale of Aragorn and Arwen, the third and final union of the Eldar and the Edain, and their reign in the Fourth Age, which restored the branches of the Half-Elven. The Annals of the Kings and Rulers, also narrated by Robert Inglis, rounds out the Saga of the Rings.
The legends, histories, and lore to be found in the sources are very extensive. Only selections from them, in most places much abridged, are here presented. Their principal purpose is to illustrate the War of the Ring and its origins, and to fill up some of the gaps in the main story. The ancient legends of the First Age, in which Bilbo's chief interest lay, are very briefly referred to, since they concern the ancestry of Elrond and the Numenorean kings and chieftains. The dates given are those of the Third Age, unless they are quoted as Second Age or Fourth Age. The Third Age was held to have ended when the Three Rings passed away in September 3021. But for the purposes of records in Gondor, Fourth Age 1 began on March the 25th, 3021. Part 1. The Numenorean Kings. Numenor. Feanor was the greatest of the Eldar in arts and lore, but also the proudest and most self-willed. He wrought the Three Jewels, the Silmarilli, and filled them with the radiance of the two trees, Telperion and Laurelin, that gave light to the land of the Valar. The jewels were coveted by Morgoth, the enemy, who stole them and, after destroying the trees, took them to Middle-earth and guarded them in his great fortress of Thangorodrim. Against the will of the Valar, Feanor forsook the Blessed Realm and went in exile to Middle-earth, leading with him a great part of his people, for in his pride he purposed to recover the jewels from Morgoth by force. Thereafter followed the hopeless war of the Eldar and the Edain against Thangorodrim, in which they were at last utterly defeated. The Edain, Atarni, were three peoples of men who, coming first to the west of Middle-earth and the shores of the Great Sea, became allies of the Eldar against the enemy. There were three unions of the Eldar and the Edain: Lúthien and Beren, Idril and Tuor, Arwen and Aragorn. By the last, the long-sundered branches of the Half-Elven were reunited, and their line was restored. Lúthien Tinúvil was the daughter of King Thingol, Great Cloak of Doriath in the First Age. But her mother was Melian, of the people of the Valar. Beren was the son of Barahir, of the first house of the Edain. Together they wrested a Silmaril from the Iron Crown of Morgoth. Luthien became mortal and was lost to Elvenkind. Dior was her son. Elwing was his daughter, and had in her keeping the Silmaril. Idril Celebrindel was the daughter of Turgon, king of the hidden city of Gondolin. Tuor was the son of Huor of the house of Hador, the third house of the Edain, and the most renowned in the wars with Morgoth. Earendil the Mariner was their son. Earendil wedded Elwing, and with the power of the Silmaril passed the shadows and came to the uttermost west, and speaking as ambassador of both elves and men, obtained the help by which Morgoth was overthrown. Earendil was not permitted to return to mortal lands, and his ship, bearing the Silmaril, was set to sail in the heavens as a star, and a sign of hope to the dwellers in Middle-earth, oppressed by the great enemy or his servants. The Silmarilli alone preserved the ancient light of the two trees of Valinor before Morgoth poisoned them, but the other two were lost at the end of the First Age. Of these things the full tale, and much else concerning elves and men, is told in the Silmarillion. The sons of Earendil were Elros and Elrond, the Perithil or half-elven. In them alone the line of the heroic chieftains of the Edain in the First Age was preserved, and after the fall of Gil-galad, the lineage of the High Elven Kings was also in Middle-earth only represented by their descendants. At the end of the First Age, the Valar gave to the Half-Elven an irrevocable choice to which kindred they would belong. Elrond chose to be of Elvenkind, and became a master of wisdom. To him, therefore, was granted the same grace as to those of the High Elves that still lingered in Middle-earth, that when weary at last of the mortal lands, they could take ship from the Grey Havens and pass into the uttermost west. And this grace continued after the change of the world. But to the children of Elrond a choice was also appointed, to pass with him from the circles of the world, or if they remained, to become mortal and die in Middle-earth. For Elrond, therefore, all chances of the War of the Ring were fraught with sorrow. Elros chose to be of mankind, and remain with the Edain, but a great lifespan was granted to him many times that of lesser men. As a reward for their sufferings and the cause against Morgoth, the Valar, the guardians of the world, granted to the Edain a land to dwell in, removed from the dangers of Middle-earth. Most of them, therefore, set sail oversea, and guided by the star of Earendil, came to the great Isle of Elenna, westernmost of all mortal lands. There they founded the realm of Numenor. There was a tall mountain in the midst of the land, the Meneltama, and from its summit the far-sighted could descry the white tower of the haven of the Eldar in Eressëa. Thence the Eldar came to the Edain, and enriched them with knowledge and many gifts, but one command had been laid upon the Numenorians, the ban of the Valar. They were forbidden to sail west out of sight of their own shores, or to attempt to set foot on the Undying Lands. For though a long span of life had been granted to them, in the beginning thrice that of lesser men, they must remain mortal, since the Valar were not permitted to take from them the gift of men, or the doom of men, as it was afterwards called. Elros was the first king of Numenor, and was afterwards known by the High Elven name Tar-Minyator. His descendants were long-lived but mortal. Later, when they became powerful, they begrudged the choice of their forefather, desiring the immortality within the life of the world that was the fate of the Eldar, and murmuring against the ban. In this way began their rebellion, which, under the evil teaching of Sauron, brought about the downfall of Numenor and the ruin of the ancient world, as is told in the Akalabith. These are the names of the kings and queens of Numenor: Elros Tar-Minyator, Vardamir, Tar-Amandil, Tar-Eledndil, Tar-Meneldur, Tar-Aldarion, Tar-Ankalime, the first ruling queen, Tar-Anarion, Tar-Surion, Tar-Telperien, the second queen, Tar-Minastir, Tar-Kiryatan, Tar-Atanamir the Great, Tar-Ankalimon, Tar-Telemaite, Tar-Vanimelde, the third queen, Tar-Alkarin, Tar-Kalmakil. After Kalmakil, the kings took the sceptre in names of the Numenorean or Adonaiic tongue: Ar-Adunahor, Ar-Zimrathon, Ar-Sakalthor, Ar-Gimilzor, Ar-Inziladun. Inziladun repented of the ways of the kings and changed his name to Tar-Palantir, the far-sighted. His daughter should have been the fourth queen, Tar-Miriel, but the king's nephew usurped the sceptre and became Ar-Tharazon, the golden, last king of the Numenoreans. In the days of Tar-Elendil, the first ships of the Numenoreans came back to Middle-earth. His elder child was a daughter, Silmarien. Her son was Valandil, first of the lords of Andúnië in the west of the land, renowned for their friendship with the Eldar. From him were descended Amandil, the last lord, and his son Elendil the Tall. The sixth king left only one child, a daughter. She became the first queen, for it was then made a law of the royal house that the eldest child of the king, whether man or woman, should receive the sceptre. The realm of Numenor endured to the end of the Second Age, and increased ever in power and splendour. And until half the age had passed, the Numenoreans grew also in wisdom and joy. The first sign of the shadow that was to fall upon them appeared in the days of Tar-Minastir, 11th king. He it was that sent a great force to the aid of Gil-galad. He loved the Eldar, but envied them. The Numenoreans had now become great mariners, exploring all the seas eastward, and they began to yearn for the west and the forbidden waters. And the more joyful was their life, the more they began to long for the immortality of the Eldar. Moreover, after Minastir, the kings became greedy of wealth and power. At first the Numenoreans had come to Middle-earth as teachers and friends of lesser men afflicted by Sauron. But now their havens became fortresses, holding wide coastlands in subjection. Atanamir and his successors levied heavy tribute, and the ships of the Numenoreans returned laden with spoil. It was Tar-Atanamir who first spoke openly against the ban and declared that the life of the Eldar was his by right. Thus the shadow deepened, and the thought of death darkened the hearts of the people. Then the Numenoreans became divided. On the one hand were the kings and those who followed them, and were estranged from the Eldar and the Valar. On the other were the few who called themselves the faithful. They lived mostly in the west of the land. The kings and their followers little by little abandoned the use of the Eldar in tongues. And at last the 20th king took his royal name in Numenorean form, calling himself Ar-Adunahor, Lord of the West. This seemed ill-omened to the faithful, for hitherto they had given that title only to one of the Valar, or to the elder king himself. And indeed, Ar-Adunahor began to persecute the faithful, and punished those who used the elven tongues openly. And the Eldar came no more to Numenor. The power and wealth of the Numenoreans nonetheless continued to increase, but their years lessened as their fear of death grew, and their joy departed. Tar-Palantir attempted to amend the evil, But it was too late, and there was rebellion and strife in Numenor. When he died, his nephew, leader of the rebellion, seized the scepter and became King Ar-Pharazôn. Ar-Pharazôn the Golden was the proudest and the most powerful of all the kings, and no less than the kingship of the world was his desire. He resolved to challenge Sauron the Great for the supremacy in Middle-earth, and at length he himself set sail with a great navy, and he landed at Umbar. So great was the might and splendour of the Numenoreans that Sauron's own servants deserted him, and Sauron humbled himself, doing homage and craving pardon. Then Ar-Pharazôn, in the folly of his pride, carried him back as prisoner to Numenor. It was not long before he had bewitched the king and was master of his council, and soon he had turned the hearts of all the Numenoreans, except the remnant of the faithful, back towards the darkness. And Sauron lied to the king, declaring that everlasting life would be his who possessed the undying lands, and that the ban was imposed only to prevent the kings of men from surpassing the Valar. "But great kings take what is their right," he said. At length Ar-Pharazôn listened to this counsel, for he felt the waning of his days and was besotted by the fear of death. He prepared then the greatest armament that the world had seen, and when all was ready, he sounded his trumpets and set sail. And he broke the ban of the Valar, going up with war to wrest everlasting life from the lords of the West. But when Ar-Pharazôn set foot upon the shores of Arman the Blessed, the Valar laid down their guardianship and called upon the One, and the world was changed. Numenor was thrown down and swallowed in the sea, and the undying lands were removed for ever from the circles of the world. So ended the glory of Numenor. The last leaders of the faithful, Elendil and his sons, escaped from the downfall with 9 ships, bearing a seedling of Nimloth, and the 7 seeing stones, gifts of the Eldar, to their house. And they were borne on the wings of a great storm, and cast upon the shores of Middle-earth. There they established in the northwest the Numenorean realms in exile, Arnor and Gondor. Elendil was the High King, and dwelt in the north at Annúminas, and the rule in the south was committed to his sons, Isildur and Anarion. They founded there Osgiliath, between Minas Ithil and Minas Arnor, not far from the confines of Mordor. For this good, at least, they believed had come out of ruin, that Sauron also had perished. But it was not so. Sauron was indeed caught in the wreck of Numenor, so that the bodily form in which he long had walked perished. But he fled back to Middle-earth, a spirit of hatred borne upon a dark wind. He was unable ever again to assume a form that seemed fair to men, but became black and hideous, and his power thereafter was through terror alone. He re-entered Mordor and hid there for a time in silence. But his anger was great when he learned that Elendil, whom he most hated, had escaped him, and was now ordering a realm upon his borders. Therefore, after a time he made war upon the exiles, before they should take root. Orodruin burst once more into flame, and was named anew in Gondor Armon Amarth, Mount Doom. But Sauron struck too soon, before his own power was rebuilt. Whereas the power of Gil-galad had increased in his absence, and in the last alliance that was made against him, Sauron was overthrown, and the One Ring was taken from him. So ended the Second Age. The Realms in Exile, the Northern Line. Eriador, Arnor, and the Heirs of Isildur. Eriador was of old the name of all the lands between the Misty Mountains and the Blue. In the south it was bounded by the Grey Flood and the Glanduin, that flows into it above Tharbad. At its greatest, Arnor included all Eriador, except the regions beyond the Lune, and the lands east of Grey Flood and Loudwater, in which lay Rivendell and Hollin. Beyond the Lune was Elvish country, green and quiet, where no men dwelt. But dwarves dwelt, and still dwell in the east side of the Blue Mountains, especially in those parts south of the Gulf of Lune, where they have mines that are still in use. For this reason they are accustomed to pass east along the Great Road, as they had done for long years before we came to the Shire. At the Grey Havens dwelt Círdan the shipwright, and some say he dwells there still, until the last ship set sail into the west. In the days of the kings, most of the high elves that still lingered in Middle-earth dwelt with Círdan, or in the seaward lands of Lindon. If any now remain, they are few. The North Kingdom and the Dúnedain. After Elendil and Isildur, there were 8 high kings of Arnor. After Iarandur, owing to dissensions among his sons, their realm was divided into 3. Arthedain, Rudar, and Cardolan. Arthedain was in the northwest, and included the land between Brandywine and Lune, and also the land north of the Great Road, as far as the Weather Hills. Rudar was in the northeast, and lay between the Ettenmoors, the Weather Hills, and the Misty Mountains, but included also the angle between the Hoarwell and the Loudwater. Cardolan was in the south, its bounds being the Brandywine, the Grey Flood, and the Great Road. In Arthedain, the line of Isildur was maintained and endured, but the line soon perished in Cardolan and Rudar. There was often strife between the kingdoms, which hastened the waning of the Dúnedain. The chief matter of debate was the possession of the Weather Hills and the land westward towards Bree. Both Rudar and Cardolan desired to possess Armansúl, Weathertop, which stood on the borders of their realms. For the Tower of Armansúl held the chief Palantir of the north, and the other two were both in the keeping of Arthedain. It was in the beginning of the reign of Malvegil of Arthedain that evil came to Arnor. For at that time the realm of Angmar rose in the north beyond the Ettenmoors. Its lands lay on both sides of the mountains, and there were gathered many evil men, and orcs, and other fell creatures. The lord of that land was known as the Witch King, but it was not known until later that he was indeed the chief of the Ringwraiths, who came north with the purpose of destroying the Dúnedain in Arnor, seeing hope in their disunion, while Gondor was strong. In the days of Argelib, son of Malvegil, since no descendants of Isildur remained in the other kingdoms, the kings of Arthedain again claimed the lordship of all Arnor. The claim was resisted by Rudar. There the Dúnedain were few, and power had been seized by an evil lord of the hillmen, who was in secret league with Angmar. Argelib therefore fortified the Weather Hills, but he was slain in battle with Rudar and Angmar. Arveleg, son of Argelib, with the help of Cardolan and Lindon, drove back his enemies from the hills, and for many years Arthedain and Cardolan held in force a frontier along the Weather Hills, the Great Road, and the Lower Hoarwell. It is said that at this time Rivendell was besieged. A great host came out of Angmar in 1409, and crossing the river entered Cardolan and surrounded Weathertop. The Dúnedain were defeated, and Arveleg was slain. The Tower of Armansúl was burned and razed, but the Palantir was saved and carried back in retreat to Fornost. Rudar was occupied by evil men subject to Angmar, and the Dúnedain that remained there were slain or fled west. Cardolan was ravaged. Arafor, son of Arveleg, was not yet full grown, but he was valiant, and with aid from Círdan he repelled the enemy from Fornost and the North Downs. A remnant of the faithful among the Dúnedain of Cardolan also held out in Tirn Gorthad, the Barrow Downs, or took refuge in the forest behind. It is said that Angmar was for a time subdued by the elven folk coming from Lindon and from Rivendell, for Elrond brought help over the mountains out of Lorien. It was at this time that the Stours, that had dwelt in the angle between Hoarwell and Loudwater, fled west and south, because of the wars and the dread of Angmar, and because the land and clime of Eriador, especially in the east, worsened and became unfriendly. Some returned to Wilderland, and dwelt beside the Glatton, becoming a riverside people of fishers. In the days of Argaleb too, the plague came into Eriador from the southeast, and most of the people of Cardolan perished, especially in Minhiriath. The hobbits and all other people suffered greatly, but the plague lessened as it passed northwards, and the northern parts of Arthedain were less affected. It was at this time that an end came of the Dúnedain of Cardolan, and evil spirits out of Angmar and Rúdar entered into the deserted mounds and dwelt there. It is said that the mounds of Tairn Gorthad, as the Barrow Downs were called of old, are very ancient, and that many were built in the days of the old world of the First Age by the forefathers of the Edain, before they crossed the Blue Mountains into Beleriand, of which Lindon is all that now remains. Those hills were therefore revered by the Dúnedain after their return, and there many of their lords and kings were buried. Some say that the mound in which the Ring-Bearer was imprisoned had been the grave of the last prince of Cardolan, who fell in the war of 1409. In 1974 the power of Angmar arose again, and the Witch-King came down upon Arthedain before winter was ended. He captured Fornost, and drove most of the remaining Dúnedain over the Lún. Among them were the sons of the king. But King Arvedwë held out upon the North Downs until the last, and then fled north with some of his guard, and they escaped by the swiftness of their horses. For a while Arvedwë hid in the tunnels of the old dwarf mines near the far end of the mountains, but he was driven at last by hunger to seek the help of the Lossoth, the snowmen of Forchel. These are a strange, unfriendly people, remnant of the Faradwaith, men of far-off days, accustomed to the bitter colds of the realm of Morgoth. Indeed, those colds still linger in that region, though they lie hardly more than 100 leagues north of the Shire. The Lossoth house in the snow, and it is said that they can run on the ice with bones on their feet, and have carts without wheels. They live, mostly, inaccessible to their enemies, on the great cape of Forchel, that shuts off to the northwest the immense bay of that name. But they often camp on the south shores of the bay, at the feet of the mountains. Some of these Arvedwë found in camp by the seashore. But they did not help the king willingly, for he had nothing to offer them, save a few jewels which they did not value, and they were afraid of the Witch-King, who, they said, could make frost or thaw at his will. But partly out of pity for the gaunt king and his men, and partly out of fear of their weapons, they gave them a little food and built for them snow huts. There Arvedwë was forced to wait, hoping for help from the south, for his horses had perished. When Círdan heard from Arnath, son of Arvedwë, of the king's flight to the north, he at once sent a ship to Forchel to seek for him. The ship came there at last after many days, because of contrary winds, and the mariners saw from afar the little fire of driftwood which the lost men contrived to keep alight. But the winter was long in loosing its grip that year, and though it was then March, the ice was only beginning to break, and lay far out from the shore. When the snowmen saw the ship, they were amazed and afraid, for they had seen no such ship on the sea within their memories. But they had become now more friendly, and they drew the king and those that survived of his company out over the ice in their sliding carts, as far as they dared. In this way a boat from the ship was able to reach them. But the snowmen were uneasy, for they said that they smelled danger in the wind. And the chief of the Lossoth said to Arvedwë, "Do not mount on this sea-monster. If they have them, let the seamen bring us food and other things that we need, and you may stay here till the Witch-King goes home. For in summer his power wanes, but now his breath is deadly, and his cold arm is long." But Arvedwë did not take his counsel. He thanked him, and at parting gave him his ring, saying, "This is a thing of worth beyond your reckoning, for its ancientry alone. It has no power, save the esteem in which those hold it who love my house. It will not help you, but if ever you are in need, my kin will ransom it with great store of all that you desire." In this way the ring of the house of Isildur was saved, for it was afterwards ransomed by the Dunedain. It is said that it was none other than the ring which Felagund of Nargothrond gave to Barahir, and Beren recovered at great peril. Yet the counsel of the Losoth was good, by chance or by foresight, for the ship had not reached the open sea when a great storm of wind arose, and came with blinding snow out of the north, and it drove the ship back upon the ice, and piled ice up against it. Even the mariners of Círdan were helpless, and in the night the ice crushed the hull, and the ship foundered. So perished Arvedwë, last king, and with him the Palantiri were buried in the sea. These were the stones of Annúminas and Armon-Súl. The only stone left in the north was the one in the tower of Emin-Beraid that looks towards the Gulf of Lún. That was guarded by the elves, and though we never knew it, it remained there until Círdan put it aboard Elrond's ship when he left. But we are told that it was unlike the others, and not in accord with them. It looked only to the sea. Elendil set it there, so that he could look back with straight sight, and see Eressëa in the vanished west. But the bent seas below covered Númenor for ever. It was long afterwards that news of the shipwreck of Forachel was learned from the snowmen. The Shire folk survived. The war swept over them, and most of them fled into hiding. To the help of the king they sent some archers, who never returned, and others went also to the battle in which Angmar was overthrown, of which more is said in the annals of the south. Afterwards, in the peace that followed, the Shire folk ruled themselves and prospered. They chose a thane to take the place of the king, and were content, though for a long time many still looked for the return of the king. But at last that hope was forgotten, and remained only in the saying, "When the king comes back," used of some good that could not be achieved, or of some evil that could not be amended. The first Shire thane was one Bakka of the Marish, from whom the old Bucks claimed descent. He became thane in 379 of our reckoning. After Arvedwë, the North Kingdom ended, for the Dúnedain were now few, and all the peoples of Eriador diminished. Yet the line of the kings was continued by the chieftains of the Dúnedain, of whom Arnoth, son of Arvedwë, was the first. Arahel, his son, was fostered in Rivendell, and so were all the sons of the chieftains after him, and there also were kept the heirlooms of their house, the ring of Barahir, the shards of Narsil, the star of Elendil, and the scepter of Annúminas. The scepter was the chief mark of royalty in Númenor, the king tells us, and that was also so in Arnor, whose kings wore no crown, but bore a single white gem. The Elendilmere, star of Elendil, bound on their brows with a silver fillet. In speaking of a crown, Bilbo no doubt referred to Gondor. He seems to have become well acquainted with matters concerning Aragorn's line. The scepter of Númenor is said to have perished with Ar-Pharazôn. That of Annúminas was the silver rod of the lords of Andúnië, and is now perhaps the most ancient work of men's hands preserved in Middle-earth. It was already more than 5,000 years old when Elrond surrendered it to Aragorn. The crown of Gondor was derived from the form of a Númenórean war helm. In the beginning it was indeed a plain helm, and it is said to have been the one that Isildur wore in the Battle of Dagolad, for the helm of Anarion was crushed by the stone cast from Barad-dûr that slew him. But in the days of Altanatar, Alcarin, this was replaced by the jewelled helm that was used in the crowning of Aragorn. When the kingdom ended, the Dúnedain passed into the shadows, and became a secret and wandering people, and their deeds and labours were seldom sung or recorded. Little now is remembered of them since Elrond departed. Although even before the watchful peace ended, evil things again began to attack Eriador, or to invade it secretly, the chieftains, for the most part, lived out their long lives. Aragorn the First, it is said, was slain by wolves, which ever after remained a peril in Eriador, and are not yet ended. In the days of Arahad the First, the orcs, who had, as later appeared, long been secretly occupying strongholds in the Misty Mountains, so as to bar all the passes into Eriador, suddenly revealed themselves. In 2509, Celebrion, wife of Elrond, was journeying to Lorien when she was waylaid in the Redhorn Pass, and her escort being scattered by the sudden assault of the orcs, she was seized and carried off. She was pursued and rescued by Eladan and Elrohir, but not before she had suffered torment and had received a poisoned wound. She was brought back to Imladris, and though healed in body by Elrond, lost all delight in Middle-earth, and the next year went to the havens and passed over sea. And later in the days of Araswyl, orcs, multiplying again in the Misty Mountains, began to ravage the lands, and the Dúnedain and the sons of Elrond fought with them. It was at this time that a large band came so far west as to enter the Shire, and were driven off by Bandobras Tuk. There were 15 chieftains, before the 16th and last was born, Aragorn the Second, who became again king of both Gondor and Arnor. Our king, we call him, and when he comes north to his house in the Numinas restored, and stays for a while by Lake Evendim, then everyone in the Shire is glad. But he does not enter this land and binds himself by the law that he has made, that none of the big people shall pass its borders. But he rides often with many fair people to the great bridge, and there he welcomes his friends, and any others who wish to see him, and some ride away with him, and stay in his house as long as they have a mind. Thane Peregrine has been there many times, and so has Master Samwise the Mare. His daughter, Eleanor the Fair, is one of the maids of Queen Evenstar. It was the pride and wonder of the Northern Line that, though their power departed and their people dwindled, through all the many generations the succession was unbroken from father to son. Also, though the length of the lives of the Dúnedain grew ever less in Middle-earth, after the ending of their kings the waning was swifter in Gondor, and many of the chieftains of the north still lived to twice the age of men, and far beyond the days of even the oldest amongst us. Aragorn, indeed, lived to be 190 years old, longer than any of his line since King Arvegil, but in Aragorn Alessar the dignity of the kings of old was renewed. Gondor and the Heirs of Anarion. There were 31 kings in Gondor after Anarion, who was slain before the Barad-dûr. The war never ceased on their borders. For more than 1,000 years the Dúnedain of the south grew in wealth and power by land and sea, until the reign of Atarnatar the Second, who was called Alcarin the Glorious. Yet the signs of decay had then already appeared, for the high men of the south married late, and their children were few. The first childless king was Falastur, and the second, Narmakil the First, the son of Atarnatar Alcarin. It was Osterhair, the seventh king, who rebuilt Minas Anor, where afterwards the kings dwelt in summer rather than in Osgiliath. In his time, Gondor was first attacked by wild men out of the east, but Tarostar, his son, defeated them and drove them out, and took the name of Romendakil, East Victor. He was, however, later slain in battle with fresh hordes of Easterlings. Turambar, his son, avenged him, and won much territory eastwards. With Tarannon, the 12th king, began the line of the ship kings, who built navies and extended the sway of Gondor along the coasts west and south of the mouths of Anduin. To commemorate his victories as captain of the hosts, Tarannon took the crown in the name of Falastor, lord of the coasts. Eärnil the First, his nephew, who succeeded him, repaired the ancient haven of Pelagia and built a great navy. He laid siege by sea and land to Umbar, and took it, and it became a great harbour and fortress of the power of Gondor. The great cape and landlocked firth of Umbar had been Numenorean land since days of old, but it was a stronghold of the king's men, who were afterwards called the Black Numenoreans, corrupted by Sauron, and who hated above all the followers of Elendil. After the fall of Sauron, their race swiftly dwindled or became merged with the men of Middle-earth. But they inherited, without lessening their hatred of Gondor. Umbar, therefore, was only taken at great cost. But Eärnil did not long survive his triumph. He was lost with many ships and men in the great storm of Umbar. Cirriandil, his son, continued the building of ships. But the men of Harad, led by the lords that had been driven from Umbar, came up with great power against the stronghold, and Cirriandil fell in battle in Haradwaith. For many years Umbar was invested, but could not be taken because of the sea power of Gondor. Cirriarhaer, son of Cirriandil, bided his time. And at last, when he had gathered strength, he came down from the north by sea and by land. And crossing the river Harnen, his armies utterly defeated the men of Harad, and their kings were compelled to acknowledge the overlordship of Gondor. Cirriarhaer then took the name of Hyamendakil, South Victor. The might of Hyamendakil no enemy dared to contest during the remainder of his long reign. He was king for 134 years, the longest reign but one of all the line of Anarion. In his day, Gondor reached the summit of its power. The realm then extended north to Celebrant and the southern eaves of Mirkwood, west to the Grey Flood, east to the Inland Sea of Rune, south to the River Harnen, and thence along the coast to the peninsula and haven of Umbar. The men of the Vales of Anduin acknowledged its authority, and the kings of the Harad did homage to Gondor, and their sons lived as hostages in the court of its king. Mordor was desolate, but was watched over by the great fortresses that guarded the passes. So ended the line of the ship kings. At-Tanatar Alcarin, son of Hyamendakil, lived in great splendour, so that men said, "Precious stones are pebbles in Gondor for children to play with." But At-Tanatar loved ease, and did nothing to maintain the power that he had inherited, and his two sons were of like temper. The waning of Gondor had already begun before he died, and was doubtless observed by its enemies. The watch upon Mordor was neglected. Nonetheless, it was not until the days of Valakar that the first great evil came upon Gondor, the civil war of the kinstrife, in which great loss and ruin was caused and never fully repaired. Minalcar, son of Calmakil, was a man of great vigour, and in 1240 Narmakil, to rid himself of all cares, made him regent of the realm. From that time onwards he governed Gondor in the name of the kings until he succeeded his father. His chief concern was with the Northmen. These had increased greatly in the peace brought by the power of Gondor. The king showed them favour, since they were the nearest in kin of lesser men to the Dúnedain, being for the most part descendants of those peoples from whom the Edain of old had come. And they gave them wide lands beyond Anduin, south of Greenwood the Great, to be a defence against men of the east. In the past, the attacks of the Easterlings had come mostly over the plain between the Inland Sea and the Ash Mountains. In the days of Narmakil the First, their attacks began again, though at first with little force. But it was learned by the regent that the Northmen did not always remain true to Gondor, and some would join forces with the Easterlings, either out of greed for spoil, or in the furtherance of feuds among their princes. Minalcar, therefore, in 1248, led out a great force, and between Rovanion and the inland sea he defeated a large army of the Easterlings and destroyed all their camps and settlements east of the sea. He then took the name of Romendakil. On his return, Romendakil fortified the west shore of Anduin as far as the inflow of the Limlight, and forbade any stranger to pass down the river beyond the Emynweal. He it was that built the pillars of the Argonath at the entrance to Nenhithuel. But since he needed men, and desired to strengthen the bond between Gondor and the Northmen, he took many of them into his service, and gave to some high rank in his armies. Romendakil showed a special favour to Vidugavir, who had aided him in the war. He called himself King of Rovanion, and was indeed the most powerful of the northern princes, though his own realm lay between Greenwood and the river Kelduin. In 1250, Romendakil sent his son Valakar as an ambassador to dwell for a while with Vidugavir, and made himself acquainted with the language, manners, and policies of the Northmen. But Valakar far exceeded his father's designs. He grew to love the northern lands and people, and he married Vidumavi, daughter of Vidugavir. It was some years before he returned. From this marriage came later the War of the Kinstrife. For the high men of Gondor already looked askance at the Northmen among them, and it was a thing unheard of before that the heir of the crown, or any son of the king, should wed one of lesser and alien race. There was already rebellion in the southern provinces when King Valakar grew old. His queen had been a fair and noble lady, but short-lived according to the fate of lesser men, and the Dúnedain feared that her descendants would prove the same, and fall from the majesty of the kings of men. Also, they were unwilling to accept as lord her son, who, though he was now called Eldakar, had been born in an alien country, and was named in his youth Vinitharia, a name of his mother's people. Therefore, when Eldakar succeeded his father, there was war in Gondor. But Eldakar did not prove easy to thrust from his heritage. To the lineage of Gondor he added the fearless spirit of the Northmen. He was handsome and valiant, and showed no sign of aging more swiftly than his father. When the confederates, led by descendants of the king, rose against him, he opposed them to the end of his strength. At last he was besieged in Osgiliath, and held it long, until hunger and the greater forces of the rebels drove him out, leaving the city in flames. In that siege and burning, the tower of the dome of Osgiliath was destroyed, and the Palantir was lost in the waters. But Eldakar eluded his enemies, and came to the north, to his kinsfolk in Rovanion. Many gathered to him there, both of the Northmen in the service of Gondor, and of the Dúnedain of the northern parts of the realm. For many of the latter had learned to esteem him, and many more came to hate his usurper. This was Castamir, grandson of Calimetar, younger brother of Romendakil II. He was not only one of those nearest by blood to the crown, but he had the greatest following of all the rebels, for he was the captain of ships, and was supported by the people of the coasts, and of the great havens of Pelagia and Umbar. Castamir had not long sat upon the throne before he proved himself haughty and ungenerous. He was a cruel man, as he had first shown in the taking of Osgiliath. He caused Ornendil, son of Eldakar, who was captured, to be put to death, and the slaughter and destruction done in the city at his bidding far exceeded the needs of war. This was remembered in Minas Anor and in Ithilien, and their love for Castamir was further lessened when it became seen that he cared little for the land, and thought only of the fleets, and purposed to remove the king's seat to Pelagia. Thus he had been king only 10 years, when Eldacar, seeing his time, came with a great army out of the north, and folk flocked to him from Cullenarthon, and Anorion, and Ithilien. There was a great battle in Lebenin at the crossings of Eriwi, in which much of the best blood in Gondor was shed. Eldacar himself slew Castamir in battle, and so was avenged for Onendil, but Castamir's sons escaped, and with others of their kin, and many people of the fleets, they held out long at Pelagia. When they had gathered there all the force that they could, for Eldacar had no ships to beset them by sea, they sailed away, and established themselves at Umbar. There they made a refuge for all the enemies of the king, and a lordship independent of his crown. Umbar remained at war with Gondor for many lives of men, a threat to its coastlands and to all traffic on the sea. It was never again completely subdued until the days of Elessar, and the region of South Gondor became a debatable land between the corsairs and the kings. The loss of Umbar was grievous to Gondor, not only because the realm was diminished in the south and its hold upon the men of the Harad was loosened, but because it was there that Ar-Pharazôn the Golden, last king of Numenor, had landed and humbled the might of Sauron. Though great evil had come after, even the followers of Elendil remembered with pride the coming of the great host of Ar-Pharazôn out of the deeps of the sea. And on the highest hill of the headland above the haven they had set a great white pillar as a monument. It was crowned with a globe of crystal that took the rays of the sun and of the moon, and shone like a bright star that could be seen in clear weather, even on the coasts of Gondor, or far out upon the western sea. So it stood, until after the second arising of Sauron, which now approached, Umbar fell under the domination of his servants, and the memorial of his humiliation was thrown down. After the return of Eldacar, the blood of the kingly house and other houses of the Dúnedain became more mingled with that of lesser men, for many of the great had been slain in the kinstrife, while Eldacar showed favour to the Northmen, by whose help he had regained the crown, and the people of Gondor were replenished by great numbers that came from Rovanion. This mingling did not at first hasten the waning of the Dúnedain, as had been feared. But the waning still proceeded, little by little, as it had before. For no doubt it was due, above all, to Middle-earth itself, and to the slow withdrawing of the gifts of the Númenóreans after the downfall of the Land of the Star. Eldacar lived to his 235th year, and was king for 58 years, of which 10 were spent in exile. The second and greatest evil came upon Gondor in the reign of Telemnar, the 26th king, whose father Midardil, son of Eldacar, was slain at Pelagia by the corsairs of Umbar. They were led by Angamite and Sangahayanda, the great-grandsons of Castamir. Soon after, a deadly plague came with dark winds out of the east. The king and all his children died, and great numbers of the people of Gondor, especially those that lived in Osgiliath. Then for weariness and fewness of men, the watch on the borders of Mordor ceased, and the fortresses that guarded the passes were unmanned. Later it was noted that these things happened even as the shadow grew deep in Greenwood, and many evil things reappeared, signs of the arising of Sauron. It is true that the enemies of Gondor also suffered, or they might have overwhelmed it in its weakness. But Sauron could wait, and it may well be that the opening of Mordor was what he chiefly desired. When King Telemnar died, the white trees of Minas Anor also withered and died. But Tarondor, his nephew, who succeeded him, replanted a seedling in the citadel. He it was who removed the king's house permanently to Minas Anor, for Osgiliath was now partly deserted and began to fall into ruin. Few of those who had fled from the plague into Ithilien or to the western dales were willing to return. Tarondor, coming young to the throne, had the longest reign of all the kings of Gondor. But he could achieve little more than the reordering of his realm within, and the slow nursing of his strength. But Telumetar, his son, remembering the death of Minardil, and being troubled by the insolence of the corsairs, who raided his coasts even as far as the Anfalas, gathered his forces, and 1810 took Umbar by storm. In that war, the last descendants of Castamir perished, and Umbar was again held for a while by the kings. Telumatar added to his name the title Umbardakil. But in the new evils that soon befell Gondor, Umbar was again lost, and fell into the hands of the men of Harad. The third evil was the invasion of the Wainriders, which sapped the waning strength of Gondor in wars that lasted for almost 100 years. The Wainriders were a people, or a confederacy of many peoples, that came from the east. But they were stronger and better armed than any that had appeared before. They journeyed in great wains, and their chieftains fought in chariots.